Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The National Sexual Violence Resource Center reports that 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men are sexually assaulted while in college. The vast majority go unreported, even though the issue of campus sexual assault is a top priority in most college onboarding programs. Two Columbia University scholars say that's too little, too late, and that the issue needs to be reframed anyway. Jennifer Hirsch is a professor of sociomedical sciences at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Seamus Khan is a professor and chair of sociology at Columbia University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having us.
They are co-directors of the Sexual Health Initiative to Foster Transformation, or SHIFT. It's one of the most in-depth studies of life and sex among today's college students. Their new book is titled Sexual Citizens, A Landmark Study of Sex, Power, and Assault on Campus. What was different about your study, Seamus? Because I've been quoting studies forever on this topic.
So there's a lot that's different about our study. You know, so much of the public attention on sexual assault is about adjudication. What do we do after these things happen? And this study takes a public health approach to ask, how do we prevent sexual assault from happening in the first place?
Okay. And how did the way you approach this get a different response or change the outcomes?
So the research that we did on the Columbia and Barnard campus, the ethnography that Seamus and I talk about, where we interviewed 151 students and spent hundreds of hours with our team socializing along them, studying students in their native environment, was part of a bigger study, the Sexual Health Initiative to Foster Transformation, which also included a survey, two surveys, and a big community engagement portion. And as a result of SHIFT, we've created a vision of prevention that suggests that we can't just tell students to have sex differently when they get to college. We need to really grapple with the fact that, unlike driving, where there's a whole social infrastructure that teaches young people how to get in a car and move through the world without damaging other people, we're not doing that same work for sex. So it's not surprising that they interact in ways that are really harmful.
And this goes back to, you know, when they landed on the shores of the East Coast, right? This is not new.
No, sexual assault isn't new, but there are aspects of today that I think are really important. You know, for example, in many colleges and universities, being in a residential institution. And one of the main concepts that we draw upon sexual geographies is an idea of the ways in which space is really important for understanding why assault happens. So, you know, if you think about two young people who are hanging out, flirting at a bar, and they decide to go back to somebody's room, when they open the door to that room, they sort of see four pieces of furniture, a desk, a chair, a bureau, and a bed. And if they're going to sit together, they have to sit together on the bed. And so we want to kind of open up a conversation to say, how is it that a range of things, like just the simple architecture of space on campus, how is that influencing the likelihood of sexual assault?
Now, of course, that architecture started a long time ago when girls and boys weren't allowed to have the other gender, the other sex in the room, right? It's based on some rules that are no longer an issue.
Well, and our recommendation wouldn't be to keep people of the other gender out of college rooms, in part because people are also assaulted by people of their same gender. But let me tell you a story, for example. So Lucy, this is a pseudonym. And
sure.
I want to warn listeners that this conversation, like the book, contains explicit descriptions of sexual assault. So Lucy, during freshman week, she had gone to boarding school and been very sheltered. She wanted to lose her virginity. She wanted to party and be popular. And she met Scott in a bar. They drank. They danced. He invited her back to his fraternity. They stumble up Amsterdam Avenue in the warm summer night, making out. Eventually, they end up, he invites her up to his room. She's excited to go up to his room. He starts taking off her pants. And she says, "No, don't." To which he says, "It's okay." And then he raped her. And so that's a terrible story. And one response to it is to think Scott is a terrible person. And another response to it is to step back and say, who taught Scott to ignore women? So that's what we do in the book, is we take a step back and think about what are the community level solutions that we can look at, because you can judge Scott all you want. That doesn't prevent him from acting that way.
Yeah, you guys say that the adjudication is the way we've been driven to this topic, is blaming and punishing. That's not where you're coming from.
I mean, we don't think that we should never punish anyone,
right,
or never blame anyone. I mean, Jennifer and I would certainly want to blame Scott for what he did in that situation. But we also want readers to, and listeners now, to know that less than 5% of the assaults are ever reported on campus. And with so few of them reported, if we just focus on those that are, on the instances that institutions hear about, we're not really going to see the big picture. We often use the analogy of an iceberg, you know, and what we do in this project is say we've been focusing on the tip of the iceberg, that tiny bit, that 5% or less that we ever see. And we want to take a deep dive beneath the water and sort of map everything else that's happening that often doesn't come to the surface in this problem.
We're talking, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about what my guest Seamus Khan just said. The vast majority of sexual assaults go unreported, even though the issue of campus sexual assault is a top priority in most college onboarding programs. He's making the point that that's because it's too little too late by the time they get to college. My guests are two Columbus University scholars, Jennifer Hirsch, professor of socio-medical sciences at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia, and also Seamus Khan, professor and chair of sociology at Columbia. They're co-directors of the Sexual Health Initiative to Foster Transformation, or SHIFT. It's one of the most in-depth studies of life and sex among today's college students. Their new book is titled Sexual Citizens, a Landmark Study of Sex, Power, and Assault on Campus. And as Jennifer Hirsch said, you know, we're going to be talking pretty graphically about sexual assault today. So, you know, be aware of that and be forewarned if that is a potential trigger. This was a big undertaking. It was a 5-year project. And it, right smack in the middle of it, I think, was the Me Too movement. And just preceding it was the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think both of those come into play here. Jennifer Hirsch, let's talk about Me Too first and how that might have— some kind of a societal shift has taken place. I'm not sure how deep it is or how much it'll resonate in the future, but something happened. Did it affect your work?
So most of the data collection that we did, all the data collection that we did was before Me Too. It was before the Harvey Weinstein case broke. And the students on our campus, like on many campuses, had gotten instruction in consent. So they could all, and they're smart. So you ask them how to do affirmative consent, they can reel it off. But we found in our research that much more frequently young people would express consent or secure consent by sending a text that says, "You up?" So they were not practicing affirmative consent, which makes sense because affirmative consent is just, it's cognitive information, and sex is a social act. It's an interpersonal act. We also found in our research, in the bigger research project, that women who'd had sex education that included training in how to say no to sex that they didn't want were half as likely to be raped in college. So you certainly—
It does help, you know.
Yes, it does help. And we're sort of facing a situation where Me Too is— needs to articulate a policy agenda. So an argument that we make is that sex education, comprehensive K through 12 sexuality education that teaches kids to think about the sex they want to have and not harm other people, that needs to be part of the Me Too policy agenda.
I was surprised reading in your book, and I actually checked the note in the book on it, that most parents in the United States support that as well. That's not the message I feel like we're getting from lawmakers.
There is a bipartisan consensus among parents that they want comprehensive sexuality education. And, you know, there are lots of reasons from this. Some of it is because parents would rather somebody else did it. And, you know, that's a little bit of the problem. But I think it's time. You know, it's time here in Ohio. It's time across a range of states. And, you know, if Jennifer and I had one thing to try and get listeners to do at the end of this conversation, it would be to pick up the phone and start demanding this, because it's not just about protecting people from experiencing assault. It's also about protecting people from committing assaults. You know, we have this vision that the assaulters are sociopaths, people that there's nothing we can do about other than punish them. And we say that there certainly are some sociopaths out there, but there are a lot of people who are committing assaults who think that they're having sex. One young man that we spoke to told us, you know, I put on a tie so I knew I was going to have sex. And he proceeded to tell us this story about how a young woman had invited him to a formal and he didn't really want to go, but she was from a high status fraternity and he was an athlete and he had a practice the next morning, so he wasn't drinking, but she kept drinking and drinking and drinking. And they end up back in his room, and he described to us having sex with her, as he said, as she went in and out of consciousness. We want to be clear, that's an assault. But he thought he was having sex, and he thought his obligation to her was to have sex with her because she'd asked him and she'd liked him. And he should have recognized that his obligation to her was to recognize her sexual citizenship, to recognize that she had the right to say yes and the right to say no to sex.
Talk about sexual citizenship. I think it's a really interesting idea, very different.
Sexual citizenship is the idea that people have the right to choose the sex that they're going to have and the sex that they're not going to have, and that they need to understand that other people have those same rights.
And there's a civic responsibility there.
Yes, that it's not just about you as a person realizing your desires, but it's about all of us in a society building a place where everybody can thrive. So I'll tell you a story. Gwen, a young woman, landed on the Columbia campus, tall, beautiful, white woman, slid into New York City club life. And she was clear, she said, about her sexual boundaries. And so she would end up after a night of clubbing in a hotel room with a not very famous actor or sort of B-list athlete. And she didn't want to have sex with them. And so she would just perform oral sex to get out of there. And eventually, after several assaults that we describe in the book, she came to understand that she didn't owe men sexual pleasure. So what kind of world have we built where a woman feels so indebted to the men around them that they don't understand their own sexual citizenship? We're not blaming Gwen. We're blaming the people who raised her.
What about in the people? Is that society writ large, too? I
yeah.
mean, the messages we get from films, from music, from pornography, all of that?
I mean, we think that this is everyone's job, and we mean literally everyone. Parents and caregivers have to do a better job opening up the conversation about sex. If you're unwilling to talk about sex with young people, if you suggest that there's something so terribly shameful about sex that we never use words about sex or describe them, you're conveying to young people that there's something terrible about this, and there are consequences. One young woman told us that drinking alcohol was like Novocaine to prepare her for having sex. If we think about that for a moment, what she was doing was sort of getting herself into a state where she no longer had to think about it to have sex because she'd grown up in such a context of shame and fear. And we need to break that context of shame and fear. And that's going to take parents. It's going to take schools. It's going to take religious organizations. It's going to take everyone to take on that challenge.
We're going to continue our conversation. If you want to join it, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm talking to two Columbia University professors, Seamus Connies and Jennifer Hirsch. They are co-authors of a new book that's based on 5 years of research. It's titled Sexual Citizens, A Landmark Study of Sex, Power, and Assault on Campus. The number's 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The National Sexual Violence Resource Center reports that 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men are sexually assaulted while in college. We're all very familiar with these kinds of statistics, and also the fact that the vast majority go unreported. Even though the issue of campus sexual assault is a top priority in most college onboarding programs, the two Columbia University scholars say that's too little, too late, and that the issue needs to be reframed. Jennifer Hirsch is a professor of sociomedical sciences at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Seamus Kahn is a professor and chair of sociology at Columbia. They're co-directors, with others, of the Sexual Health Initiative to Foster Transformation, or SHIFT. It's one of the most in-depth studies of life and sex among today's college students. Their new book is titled Sexual Citizens, A Landmark Study of Sex, Power, and Assault on Campus. Could you talk a little bit about the study and kind of the components of it and the pieces of it? Yours is what came out in the book is not the entire deal.
So in the summer of 2014, as I was observing the national conversation on sexual assault, it seemed to me like there was a piece missing. And that piece was understanding sexual assault as a predictable feature of daily life, right? We've known for decades that this happens. And so thinking about it as the product of broken people is not going to move us forward. We need to think about it as the product of a broken systems that make this an expected thing that happens, a terrible thing, but an expected thing. And so I reached out to Columbia to suggest that we would do this, and they were supportive. And so with my friend Claude Ann Mellons, who's a clinical psychologist, we developed the Sexual Health Initiative to Foster Transformation, which had three pieces. There was the ethnographic piece, which Seamus and I worked on together, which involves spending time with students in their daily lives and interviewing them. There were two forms of survey research, and then there was a big community engagement component. So we had a group of undergraduates who worked with us as our advisory board. We met with them every Monday at 8 a.m. for the duration of the data collection, and they helped us figure out how to ask questions, how to recruit students. We got a 67% response rate in the survey, and part of that was because students saw participating in the research as a way to help solve the problem. So it was a big team. It was a more than $2 million research project supported by the university that included eight faculty members and over 30 people overall. It was sort of a like a moonshot level way of approaching it.
And how many students participated in the research?
So in the survey, it was a random population survey. We asked 2,500 people to participate, and 1,667 actually agreed to participate. On a different survey, a diary survey, we had over 400 students participate. Jennifer and I are on our team, interviewed 151 students. We ran focus groups that had 17 focus groups that had about 10, 12 people each. So that was another 200 students. And then I think really important to this was being embedded in the life of campus. We had researchers hanging out in fraternity basements and in sororities. We had researchers in religious spaces. We had researchers, you know, hanging out on athletic bus, joining intramural sports leagues. And so we also have a way in which we can look at the whole lives of young people. So much of the attention to sexual assault is on that moment of consent when people are having sex. And what's a little bit different about our project is that we want to put that in the context of people's entire lives and to pull back the curtain on what it's like to be a college student today and how that explains why sexual assault is so common.
We have an email from Chris who says, I agree with the guest's perspective related to prevention and how the larger context contributes to the problem. It also sounds like public health is a good research approach. However, to what extent does the focus on the two colleges they mentioned limit their ability to generalize to the more diverse demographics of higher education, which is something you address in the book, right?
So Columbia is obviously, Columbia and Barnard are an urban campus. They're highly selective. So there's no question they're not representative of the general experience in higher education in America, which is being a student at a community college. That's a much more typical perspective. But the questions that we ask about prevention, we talk about space as a form of vulnerability, how the spaces where students spend time together socially and sexually make them likely to, or at least set up the conditions for assault. Let me tell you a story. Mm-hmm. So Austin, in many ways, was one of the most likable characters in the book. There's one very sweet sex scene on a hot summer night with him and his girlfriend. I'm not telling that on the radio. Mm-hmm. But He had developed a set of nicknames for the kinds of orgasms his girlfriend had because he was really committed to being a good boyfriend, and that included in his mind being a good lover. And yet he told us a story about being in a room late at night, freshman year, very anxious about not having had a lot of sexual experience. He was in the room with a girl who was the roommate of his She was another girl who was shuffled into his room late at night. Mm-hmm. She said to him she was drunk and not interested in doing anything. And yet he got in bed with her and started touching her body. And so that's an assault, right? And then he stopped himself. He thought, this is not the thing. And you can't understand that moment when Alston assaulted that woman without thinking about the way college students are shuffled together late at night into other people's rooms. So the questions about space, even if the Columbia and Barnard context are very particular, are relevant to any campus experience.
In the process of doing these interviews with the 150 students, and I guess also the diaries are fascinating to me, were there any moments of epiphany for them while they were literally talking about it, kind of going, whoa?
There were many moments of epiphany, and I think part of the explanation for that is that very few adults had ever sat down with these young people and talked to them about their sexual lives. One of the concepts that we have in the book is sexual projects, and a sexual project is an answer to the question, what is sex for? Almost nobody had sat down, the young people we spoke to, and said to them, you know, sex is going to be a really important part of your life. It's going to be a part of your life where you connect to some of the people that you're closest to, and you need to think about what you want from that. You know, Austin, the story that Jennifer just told, when he told us this story about being in the bed with that woman and touching her and realizing he shouldn't be doing that, in that interview was the first time he realized that it was an assault. And he was crushed by this. He, you know, used expletives to talk about himself and sort of said, like, God, I guess I'm a terrible person. And, you know, our point in using Austin in the way that we do in the book is to show that, you know, he did something that was wrong. He did something that he shouldn't have done. It's not clear to us that he's a terrible person. And it is clear to us that we need to think about the ways in which we've construct our communities and the ways in which we've raised our young people so that he is less likely to do something like that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Seamus Khan. He's co-author of the book Sexual Citizens, a Landmark Study of Sex, Power, and Assault on Campus. Also with us, Jennifer Hirsch, co-author of Sexual Citizens, a Landmark Study of Sex, Power, and Assault on Campus. And they will be speaking today at Ohio State University. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You know, if you're part of the boomers, you know, like me, you know, this was not even anything on anybody's radar at all. Now it's a regular part of the onboarding process at just about every university and college in the world, because it's such a prevalent problem. Khan and Hirsch are saying that the approach we're taking, though, is too little too late and is the wrong approach. If you have a question or comment, again, 614-292-8513. Let's talk about, well, before we move on, I asked you earlier about the Black Lives Matter movement. We talked about the Me Too. And these are just two things that kind of happened around, you know, in that same generation. Let's put it that way. What did that matter? How did that play a role in what you were talking about and asking about?
Well, you can't talk about sexual assault without thinking about power. And even though people might, you know, the story I told you earlier about Scott and Lucy. So obviously he's a man, she's a woman. He has probably 40 pounds on her. So he's there's a gender dynamic, but he was also in a space that he controlled. He was 3 years older. So there are all other dimensions of power. And race is an important one. It doesn't figure in that story, but it does figure very significantly throughout the book. We spoke with Black women, every single Black woman that we spoke with had experienced unwanted, non-consensual sexual touching. And so you can't interpret those assaults only through a lens of gender. You have to also think about racial domination, and race and sexual assault are woven into American history.
Yeah, I mean, we spoke to one young man in the book. We call him Carl, and he told us this story of a woman who he'd met at the bar, and she asked if they could go back to his place. And he sort of assessed that she wasn't really sober enough. And so he insisted that they walk around the campus and the neighborhood for about an hour. And then they went back to his place, and he still thought, I don't think she's sober enough. And Carl's fear here was like many men's fear of being accused. But Carl was a Black man, and his fears of false accusation were so much greater than any of the other men that we spoke to. And so, you know, he finally thought, okay, she's sober enough, we can have sex, and they had sex. And afterwards, Carl recorded her saying what a great time she'd had. And he'd done his homework. He'd actually looked up to see that New York State was a one-party consent state, meaning he could legally make a recording of her saying she had a good time without her knowing about it, and it would be admissible in court. If you think about that for a moment, just his profound racialized fear of what it would mean to be brought before the court system and the steps that he takes to sort of make sure that he can feel better about the sex that he's having, you can't understand the ways in which people are traversing their sexual lives on college campuses and not on college campuses without an understanding of the experience of race in America.
And that's a relatively new dynamic, though, the fear of being accused. And I say, I mean, it's not, it didn't seem part of the lexicon 40 or 50 years ago.
That's true. It didn't seem part of the, I think back to my own days in college, and the only moment when there was an acknowledgement of sexual assault as a problem was the annual Take Back the Night March, when people would walk around campus and tell their stories. And that was sort of when sexual assault burst onto the public consciousness and then was pushed aside again.
And it was also framed in that someone's going to jump out at you from a bush, kind of the Take Back the Night thing. It always felt like to me it was a stranger assault, not with somebody you knew.
Yes, I think that's true. And also going back to the 1980s, there's been a conversation about date rape. That was the phrase that people used to use. So I think that that has been part of the consciousness. But I think what's been missing is a notion of sexual assault in which we acknowledge that the people who commit the assaults are people who are in our community, right? So that they could be our sons, our brothers, people we like. Most people, remember, are assaulted by people they know. And so if you think about the assaulter as other, I think that makes it hard for people who might be hurting other people to acknowledge that what they're doing is assault. It was very hard for Austin in that moment to see himself as an assaulter because he had always thought of assaulters as people who are bad people. And I think he kind of thought he wasn't a bad person.
Yeah, there are other groups, too. It's a very touching, very moving, sad story about a guy who's an immigrant. He's he can't tolerate being at home because his parents don't approve that he's LGBTQ. He's in the LGBTQ category, and he doesn't want to live at home because of that. I mean, it's kind of maybe oversimplified, but he's also homeless. And he's going to Columbia, so hell, you know, everybody out there who has their generalizations about Columbia University, it actually has a lot of diversity to it. He's probably an exception, but
yeah, he's an exception, but you know, fewer than half the students that we interviewed were white, and so we really spoke to a range of people across racial and ethnic identities, and you know, about 20% of the students that we spoke to didn't identify as heterosexual, and that experience, the experience of the LGBTQ community, is very, very important because in the survey work as part of this larger project, the survey that Claude Ann Mellons led, you know, one of the things that we found was that LGBTQ students had some of the highest rates of assault. And that's consistent with many other surveys on a national level. And we need to think about why it is that LGBTQ students experience assault at such high rates. And it returns to what Jennifer had said earlier, an attention to power. And when we think about sexual assault, we think about gender and power usually. But we need to expand that to think about the ways in which the young man that you just described, who experienced homelessness during the breaks, he was experiencing a financial precarity. He didn't have money. And that ended up being incredibly consequential. For LGBTQ students, there were sort of many times within which, you know, their experiences of sexuality put them at risk. One young man we spoke to told us a story. He'd grown up in a conservative family, and they weren't really accepting of his sexuality. But the values that they held really influenced him, and he didn't want to be part of what he saw as the sort of casual sex scene among gay men in New York City. And so for him, it was so important to be in a relationship. And he finally found a relationship, and he was so happy about that relationship. But he also told us how his boyfriend was really forceful about sex. And he said, you know, one night my boyfriend came home and he was pretty drunk and he basically raped me. But what this young man said to us, we call him Adam in the book, was that, like, it was just something he was willing to tolerate because the relationship was so important. He didn't want to be part of a hookup scene. He didn't want to be on Grindr. He wanted to preserve that thing. And to explain Adam's experiences, we need to think about the sort of ways in which being an LGBTQ student sort of puts you at risk because of the precariousness of it, because people don't accept who you are. And that means being attentive to power and sexuality.
There was another story you tell in the book about a guy, is it more from the terms of the young woman who realized she probably had raped a gay guy who was a really good friend of hers.
Yeah, she, I remember, I will never forget interviewing her. She seemed pretty broken by that experience. So they had had a sort of like sexual banter. And at one point he said to her, "I think I'm moving down the Kinsey scale for you."
Meaning
that I think you're turning
straighter.
Me straight. Yeah. And she was like, bam, that's the sexiest thing anyone ever said to me. And I think that she misunderstood that as that he was potentially down to have sex. And so she verbally coerced him into having sex with her. And she said to him later, "Did I rape you?" And he was like, "I didn't want to do that." And so she felt pretty wrecked by this experience. To her, it was inconceivable that a man wouldn't always be up for sex. And so one of the things that we describe in the book is the way this sort of Jane Austen era narrative in which women mostly have the job of being the blockers for sex and it's men's job to move the ball down the field leaves women in a position of sometimes assaulting men because they don't even think to really check with them to make sure if they want to have sex. They just assume that they're down for it.
We're going to take a break. We're going to take some calls when we return. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The National Sexual Violence Resource Center reports that 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men are sexually assaulted while in college. You've heard this story before. The vast majority go unreported, even though the issue of campus sexual assault, it's a top priority in most college onboarding programs now. Two Columbia University scholars say that that's too little, too late, and that the issue needs to be reframed. Anyways, Jennifer Hirsch is a professor of sociomedical sciences at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia. Seamus Khan is a professor and chair of sociology at Columbia. They're co-directors of the Sexual Health Initiative to Foster Transformation, or SHIFT. It's one of the most in-depth studies of life and sex among today's college students. And a book based in part on that is titled Sexual Citizens, A Landmark Study of Sex, Power, and Assault on Campus. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. I wanted to talk about substance use. Slash abuse, which is prevalent and has been for a long time on college campuses. It's sort of like the other character in almost every story.
It is, but it's not every story.
Right.
So, you know, in the survey that Claude Mellons led, we found that a little over half of the assaults were perpetrated under conditions of intoxication or substance use. But that means that about half of them weren't, or, you know, about 45% of them. And one of the points of the book is that sexual assault is not one thing. It's many different things. There are lots of things that explain what are happening, and we're going to need to take a multi-sectoral approach. And what that means is we can't just have a single solution to this problem. We can't just do consent education and imagine that it's going to go away. You know, we heard stories from people who were in relationships who were pressured into consenting to have sex that they didn't want to have. In terms of alcohol, we really think that we need to have a harm reduction approach to alcohol and think about the ways in which there are a lot of unintended consequences to the policies that we have, particularly in residential colleges. So if you take freshmen, for example, one of the things that colleges often do is police alcohol consumption on freshman dorms. Now, we're not saying that you absolutely have to give up on policing that, but what happens when you take a bunch of freshmen and you say, you can't drink in this space? Well, the consequence is that they go into other spaces and they drink. And those spaces that they go into are usually controlled by older men. And so one of the consequences of a lot of our alcohol policies is to push younger people into more vulnerable positions. And we want to expand then the conversation about substance use to think about why is it that people are using substances in the ways that they are to drink so excessively? And we think that part of the explanation is that we've created a culture of shame around sex. And what are some of the unintended consequences of our alcohol policies that are putting people at risk?
And it tends to be it's alcohol is the more predominantly figuring in these.
There were definitely stories that we heard. I think about one story in the book of a young woman who had mixed together multiple substances, including alcohol. So as students describe it, she was crossed and she was in her bed and she was very vulnerable when her roommate's boyfriend's friend said he was cold and wanted to get in bed with her. And she was kind of out of it. And she was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And then he coerced her into giving him oral sex. And at the end of it, she was like, I thought you were just cold. Like she was very vulnerable in that moment because she was intoxicated by so many different substances. Certainly, it's not only alcohol. It's the, you know, poly substance use is a source of vulnerability.
Well, let's go to some calls. Jody in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jody.
Yes, hi. I think some of my question has been answered because I was having some concern about the use of alcohol and the vulnerability that it puts women at, and also, you know, just some training and a discussion about usage of alcohol and being so out of it that you're, you know, so drunk that you don't know what's happening to yourself. And where's that responsibility also for young women to take, too, for putting themselves in situations where they lack the control? So, I do have some concerns around educating women as to how much is too much and making sure that you're protected.
Yeah,
I'll
thank
take
you,
my
Jody. And we're not just talking about women, though.
No, I think Jody's question really is a question that we hear a lot about, you know, what is the responsibility of people who are in these situations? And one of the ways in which Jennifer and I, you know, try and open up that conversation is also to talk about alcohol and risk, where alcohol also makes people at risk of committing assault. So we usually think about the risks of alcohol, of the risks of becoming a victim. But I think it's really important to note that alcohol increases the likelihood that you'll perpetrate an assault. And one of the things that we need to do in expanding the conversation about alcohol is say to young men and to young women, but particularly to young men since they commit the vast majority of assaults, when you do this, when you drink this much, you are much more likely to do something you probably don't want to do, which is assault somebody. Because when you're out of your mind drunk, you're not as responsive to people's cues. You don't really process them in the same way. And you end up sort of just pursuing your own wants and desires. So we want to open up that part of the conversation, as well as why is it that college students are drinking in the way that they're drinking? What are the levels of stress and anxiety that they have? What is the sense of shame that they have around sex? And how, as I said before, the one woman who said to us, sex was like, alcohol was like Novocaine so that I could have sex because I felt like I shouldn't be doing it. How are we creating young people with those feelings? And how could we take what in public health we call a harm reduction approach to alcohol? Young people don't just drink and then happen to have sex. They often drink in order to have sex. Mm. And some of the older people listening may actually think about their own lives and recognize that some of us do the same things. And we might ask why that is and what it says about the organization of sex and sexuality in American life that drives us to act in those ways.
Joe, in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Hey, I am fascinated by the topic, especially as a professor of sociology. You're covering an awful lot, sex, drugs, and alcohol. But the fact is, I got to always kind of wonder, when we take these kinds of situations to the college level, and then we talk about it as we do here in this discussion, where's that opportunity? You know, you mentioned too little, too late. Why aren't we talking about this with our kids, and who's responsible ultimately first about what's going on at home, how we're conversing with our kids at the various stages of their lives, and how we're introducing these topics to them and trying to give them the understanding, insights, and and the chance to talk about things as they come up. Are we taking responsibility as parents in raising these kids to, you know, have some clarity in their lives before they get to that point?
Yeah, we talked about that early on, about how it was on a bipartisan approval by parents across the country, but it's not happening for sex education.
Well, so I think certainly parents across the political spectrum support sex education. And I think the question is also about what is parents' responsibility as parents to form humans who won't hurt other people sexually. If you think about raising children and teaching them to manage their bodies, we teach them so many times as a parent, you say, use your words, don't grab things. That is a sexual assault prevention message. We just need to help them make the connection between the basic forms of interpersonal respect that it is our job as parents to teach and not sexually assaulting people.
It's in the book, you know, you make the point that if we never referred to our neck or our ankles and we ignore those parts of our anatomy, eventually there's a reason why we don't.
Right. And so using shaming language, using terms that are not medically accurate about genitals, conveys a message to young people, to our children, about shame and what's unspeakable. Forcing children to kiss relatives at the holidays gives them a message about their lack of sexual autonomy, right? It's even though the kisses aren't sexual, you're saying like the social use of your body is more important than what you really want to do. So there are all kinds of opportunities for us as parents, and that is our job, right? It's not anybody else's job to convey those messages. It's our job. And so parents need to step up and raise children who are clear about their own boundaries and respectful of other people's bodies.
Step up, even if it means that when you broach the subject, they run out of the room at first.
Well,
just keep stepping up.
And, you know, I think also that there's so many of these lessons, like Jennifer said, that they're not really about sex.
Yeah.
I mean, talking to young people about bodily autonomy, about how if another person doesn't want to be touched, don't touch them. And if you don't want to be touched, express that. That's not a lesson about sex. It's a lesson about bodily autonomy. And we need, you know, those lessons can start very young. You know, 2-year-olds can be getting those lessons. And we need to build a foundation. So it's not, you know, Jennifer and I are not saying that we need to have comprehensive education for two-year-olds about how to have sex. What we're saying is that we need to have a foundation of building a sense of sexual citizenship, which is your right to say yes and your right to say no to things and other people's equivalent rights, a recognition. And this is about a moral language of sexuality that isn't about how who you're having sex with, but a moral language of sexuality about how you treat other people. And the more connections that we can make with the basic lessons that we give young people from their earliest days, the better a foundation we'll have to raise sexual citizens.
Joe, I hope that helped. Thanks for your call. Let's see, Arshad in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Arshad.
How's it going, Ann?
Good.
It's a good point mentioning the, you know, the moral language of sex. You know, I'm in college right now, and I hear a lot about making sex a more discussable, normal part of everyday life. And, you know, I think I really appreciate that because the way we deal with things, we talk about them. But I also wonder if making it, how do I say this, if making it more discussable, more normal, potentially runs the risk of making it less weighty, you know, because it's ever-present, because it's not necessarily discussed, but, you know, because it's kind of everywhere, and because we hear a lot about how it shouldn't be feared. I wonder a lot of times in some of these conversations if it's made less of a moral decision, if it's treated with less regard and less maybe discipline than it otherwise might have been.
You know, I think it's a really interesting question. I think, you know, I might answer it with an analogy. Like, if we have more conversations about faith, does, you know, God become suddenly less important to us? I don't think that's right. I mean, I think actually having conversations about something important matters makes them even more important. And, you know, one of the things that we find in the book is that people endure sexual experiences because they don't have the language to actually express their wants and desires. And normalizing a conversation about people's wants and desires empowers them to actually say what they want. We have so many times where young people told us they got consent education. They were told about the importance of saying no. But all the other lessons that they gotten from their communities, from their parents, were about how you can't talk about sex. And so in that moment, even though they knew that they should say no, or that they should listen for a no, or that they should say yes, or that they should listen for a yes, they just didn't have the vocabulary, in part because those conversations hadn't been normalized. They hadn't practiced listening for a yes. They hadn't practiced expressing their wants and desires. And so we want people to build that foundation through practice.
Arshad, thank you for that question. That's a great question. Bill in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think, you know, a couple of things you've talked about have started to hit to the, you know, get to the point that I wanted to make, but I'll make it anyway. I think, you know, alcohol is one thing, but you can't just come out of the gate and say it's about alcohol, because it's so much more than that. And then education, where you talked about being able, you know, girls being able to say no. But what about the other side of it? You know, with the Me Too movement, look at how many ugly examples of guys taking advantage of women have come to the surface. I think it's a societal issue, and I think we're starting to address it with Me Too, but we have a long way to go.
We have a long way to go, and I think that the overall overriding point is about equality, that you can't talk about sexual assault without talking about power inequality. There were so many different kinds of inequalities that produced the assaults we describe in the book. And so, yes, this is all about equality.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Jennifer made the point earlier that racial justice is essential to sexual assault prevention, but all kinds of equalities are essential to sexual assault prevention. I mean, look at fraternity and sorority life. In fraternity and sorority life, fraternities are allowed to serve alcohol and sororities aren't. This gives men control over the distribution of alcohol and use of party spaces on campus. That is a fundamentally inequitable thing that is the result of the policies of Greek-like organizations. There's something that we can do about that. And I think, you know, if we begin to think about everyday inequalities, everyday ways in which some people are really empowered and other people are really disempowered, and how we could address those, that also becomes a fundamental way in which we begin to address sexual assault.
My guest, that's Seamus Khan. He is co-author of Sexual Citizens, a landmark study of sex, power, and assault on campus. And his co-author, Jennifer Hirsch, of that book. They are also professors at Columbia University, where they conducted a five-year research project on this topic with others, many others. They are going to be speaking tonight at Ohio State, later this afternoon at Ohio State. You can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about that. And until then, I want to say thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it. Seamus Khan and Jennifer Hirsch, thank you.
Thanks for lifting up this conversation.
Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Aaron Esmont, producer Matthew Rand, AllSides interns Atiya Ture, Bobby Gerberic, and Max Garrison, with video production by Nick Payne. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.